Please sit down. Most venerable members of the Sangha, Venerable Ajahn Brahm, Honorable Prime Minister, Honorable Ministers, special invitees, ladies and gentlemen. This is a special session organized for the benefit of professionals and the officers from the government. It's wonderful to see such a large crowd at this evening. At the outset, we would like to thank the organizers of the 7th World Buddhist Supreme Conference, which started a few days ago in Sri Lanka, and Venerable Ajahn Brahm was here for that program. And a special thank to the Honorable Prime Minister for inviting him to deliver 2 speeches at Temple Trees. Thank you very much, sir. If not for you, this wouldn't have happened. And providing this beautiful location for the event. And a special thank to the team of the Temple Trees who worked tirelessly to make this event are possible. And it's over to you, Bande. We are very fortunate to have you again. A few years, last time you spoke about, I think 4 years ago. And you have a large following here, as you can see. Over to you, Bande. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And venerable sirs, it's very nice to see you again. And brothers and sisters in the Dhamma, it is a privilege to be here once again. And again, thank you to the Prime Minister for arranging this, and also thank you to the organizers of the 7th World Buddhist Summit for allowing me to use this opportunity to share the Dhamma. The World Buddhist Summit has their intention to spread the Dhamma, to be able to help many beings in our world experience a peaceful, successful, harmonious life, to being about a greater degree of world peace. And in order to do that, it is wonderful to have ceremonies, it's wonderful to meet one another, but it's also part of the teachings of the Buddha, is to share, to give teachings which are relevant to our modern age, when we were talking about how to bring more children into the Dhamma and to teach them so they can learn from these ancient teachings, grow and enjoy going to the temple. But today the emphasis is on professionals, those who are in business and in other areas such as the civil service, in governments, so that they can use these teachings of the Buddha in a way which enhances their work experience, which increases the economy, their GDP, because in my life I have found that these teachings of the Dhamma, they can enhance, increase the benefits, the experience of all parts of our life, including in business. Just 1 week ago, I was giving a seminar in Singapore, and it was on using Buddhist principles in business. And there, presenting alongside of me, was Mr. Chu Beng Tan. He was a former head of Keppel Shipping, and at the time, he's retired now. At the time, he was the highest paid CEO in Singapore. There's also Jason Tan, who is currently the manager of Changi Airport, and he was just completed a few days earlier the opening of Terminal 4 in Changi Airport. And there was also a few investment bankers and people who write articles for Bloomberg. These were professionals at the apex of their career, but they were also very sincere Buddhists. Buddhists who wanted to share how they could practice the teachings of the Buddha in their workplace to be leaders, not of just companies, but leaders in ethics, leaders in kindness, and at the same time, becoming very successful leaders, entrepreneurs, CEOs. And they shared many, many parts of their experience at work on how we can bring these Buddhist practices into our business environment. As you all know, you will spend many hours, a great proportion of your life, at the office. And the experience you have at the office will affect much of your life at home and elsewhere. So how we can enhance our work experiences, we can employ many of the Buddhist principles. In order to be successful, without getting things like cardiac disease. A person once told me, actually it was a psychologist who gave a talk channel. And on that TED talk channel, they were comparing, why is it that some CEOs in major businesses, some do have cardiac disease, while others are very healthy? Is it the fact that some people have more responsibilities, more worries, or is there some other reason? And doing her research, she found out, quite convincingly, that it is not the amount of work or stress which you have to deal with in positions of leadership, but it is very much how you deal with that stress, with that decision-making in leadership positions. It is whether we can learn to make decisions carefully, with consideration, but decisively, without worrying too much. Too many people, they have important decisions to make in life, and they carry them around as a burden in their hearts, in their minds, and that causes such stress that, as they say, there is the cholesterol sticks to the arteries, and you have major problems, cardiac disease. Other people, because they have the same amount of duties, the same amount of stress, they do not worry too much. They take it as a challenge. They don't have any negativity to the position they have to be in. They enjoy their responsibilities, which means that they don't have any problems with their cholesterol, which means they have good cardiac health. Those are the people which prove that it's not the stress, the work, the responsibility, the weight of responsibility, which is the cause of cardiac disease. It is the attitude we have towards what we have to do. So, first of all, please never imagine that because you have to work hard, that it has to be stressful. As some of you may know, that I work very hard as a Buddhist monk. I have huge amounts of responsibilities. And sometimes I travel around the world, talking, sharing, but I do not get stressed out. I can still always enjoy whatever I have to do. So here is one of the stories, which I like telling stories, about how we deal with the very difficult things we have to do in our life. This was a story from my training in the jungles of Thailand in a forest monastery many years ago. My teacher was a monk called Ajahn Chah. First of all, how come I found a monk like Ajahn Chah? Now, you may know that I'm an English-born monk. When I went to Thailand and I found there was a monk, Ajahn means teacher, like Acharya, whose second name meant tea, cha, I thought, that's the monk for me. So, when I went to stay with Ajahn Chah, he was a very powerful, wise monk who taught from experience, from wisdom, with deep meditation, and from the sutra as well. But on this one occasion, he just finished building a huge Upasatha hall, the ordination hall, a Sema hall. And after he finished building it, because that area of northeast Thailand was flat, it would get flooded during the heavy monsoon rains. So he built it, you know, maybe 1 meter, 2 meters above ground, on a mound of earth. But after it was completed, there was a huge amount of earth left over. And he asked us monks, can you please move that earth? Now at that time, I was only eating one meal a day in the morning. It was a very simple meal without much nourishment. At that time, I was extremely thin. I'm making up for it now. And at that time, we were working very hard. We finished our one meal of the day after the Bindabhata, maybe about 9 o'clock. And from 9 o'clock until we couldn't see at night, we would use shovels to put the excess earth into a wheelbarrow, and then to move that earth into the place where Ajahn Chah told us. It took us 3 days, 3 days of hard labor, pushing the earth through the steamy forest jungles of northeast Thailand, sweating, dirty, tired on one meal a day, being bitten by mosquitoes who took advantage of us. Those mosquitoes at those days in Thailand, they had never eaten Western food before. So now this was the first delicacy, Western food. After 3 days, I was exhausted. I was dirty. I hadn't had a chance to wash your robes. And very, very tired. But we finished after 3 days, and I thought, now I could relax, rest. Following morning, I wash all my robes and do some meditation and recover. However, that night, Ajahn Chah, the teacher, the Hamdro, went to another monastery. And the second monk, the vice abbot, asked us after our 1 meal a day, he said, I've been thinking, I don't think that earth is in the correct place. Please move it. So 3 more days of hard work, shoveling earth, pushing it in a wheelbarrow, through the mosquito-laden jungles, sweaty, dirty, really stinky. But we finished. Our 6 days of hard work. Now I can relax and rest and have some meditation the next day and wash everything. I was really stinky. However, that night, Ajahn Chah returned. You already know what happened next. He said, why do you put it over there? I told you to put it over this other place. Move it. Now, for all those 6 days, although it was hard work, I had a lot of faith in my teacher. We have gratitude for the people who have served us and helped us. It was a small repayment for all the wisdom and kindness my teacher had given me. However, even gratitude and faith has its limit. And I'd passed my limit by now. And I was thinking, after another 3 days of hard work, I never became a bhikkhu to work like this. I became a monk to meditate under the trees, in the caves, quietly, peacefully. This is exploitation. So, I was very upset. I'd lost my faith. And what happened was, I started to swear in English, hoping that the Thai monks wouldn't understand what I was saying. I was still a young monk. But they understood, because they could see the body language. You can tell when a person's angry and upset, and I was angry and upset. And it was at that point, one of the monks came up to me and gave me a wonderful teaching, which I'm sharing with you now, of how to deal with the stress of your work life. He told me, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. Pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. It's thinking about it is the hard part. And how true that was for me. As soon as you stop thinking and complaining, pushing the wheelbarrow became so easy. To me, the stress was not the hard work, but the thinking, the negativity, the complaining about it inside. And to this day, whatever task you have to do at your work, doing it is the easy part. It is thinking about it. That is the hard part. Whatever decisions you have to push through governments, whatever strategies you have to decide in your company, whatever you have to do in your life, you will always find that thinking about it overmuch is the problem. Doing it is very easy. So that's where I learned just how to deal with anything which I have to deal with in life. Giving talks, being jet-lagged, going and having my photograph taken, which I don't know why. When I was young and handsome, I wanted to take the photograph of me. Now I'm old. But whatever we do without complaint. But we do have to make decisions sometimes. And when we make decisions, decisions which will affect ourselves and many other people, I've often noticed the decision-making processes in a company are sometimes flawed. That decision-making in a company has to be considered. And as the Buddha said, whenever we make any decisions, we should always consider what he called the 4 agati, to make sure that we are not acting out of lobha, dosa, moha, and also the last one, fear. So lobha, dosa, moha, I think you all know, is like greed, ill will, or stupidity, delusion. To make sure it's not just in our personal interest, it's in a greater interest for our company, our country, for the people who work for us. And also, not from ill will. We're not doing this out of spite. And not out of delusion, stupidity. We gather as much information as we possibly can, so we're well informed. And lastly, we're not acting out of fear. And acting out of fear is one of the reasons why people do not make good decisions. They're afraid of what other people will say about them. They're afraid of their personal reputation. If it is something which you really believe in, which you know you should do, for your company, for your country, for your religion, whatever it is, it's something which you feel very deeply about, please don't act out of fear. Do you find that fear stops people, stops companies innovating, progressing, and stops people taking chances? This is something which I learnt when I was a student at Cambridge. We found that many, many people, including myself, had some ideas, experiments to perform, things to try. And when I was at Cambridge, they would never say, no, that will not work. They would always say, give it a try, see what happens. You're always encouraged to give things a try without fear. 1,000 experiments, 1,000 ideas, 999 of them would fail. But the one which worked would push the barriers of knowledge further, would invent, see new dimensions, new things, new applications. It was called innovation. So people were encouraged to try new things, to go to new places, to see new things. That was not acting out of fear. But of course, you have to be responsible. When a person does make a decision in business, we worry so much, we expend so much of our energy before we make decisions. And one thing which I have discovered, which is an important part of the Dhamma, is that once you've made a decision, really it is not a right decision or a wrong decision before you decide. It's after you decide. You make it a right decision. Or, because of heedlessness, you make it a wrong decision. Once you made the decision to go left or to go right, that is where you put most of your energy and commitment. To make sure that it's a decision which will work. You put the effort in to after you made the decision. So, in companies, decision making, we commit, after we made that decision, to work really hard to make sure that that decision is going to work. We don't worry too much beforehand, but we certainly worry afterwards, once a decision is committed to. But of course, it's tough in business, and especially many people complain about bosses and what they call bosses from hell. Difficult people which you have to deal with. And first of all, sometimes you can ask people, are you one of those difficult bosses to deal with? Do you always complain about others? But in here we have many bosses, many leaders. Are you one of those? Be honest about it. Are you difficult to deal with? And of course, if you're honest, many of you are difficult to deal with. And why is that? This is not a personal failing. It is because a person who is in positions of authority have to make decisions quite quickly, and are decisions which can be disagreed with by many people, agreed with others. You have to take that responsibility to use your experience and wisdom to say, this is the decision which I have to do. It is one of the reasons why that in the discussion I had with business leaders, we had to encourage everybody to have empathy.
have empathy for a person in authority and the limitations which they have, and whether you could do the same in such a position, or you could do better. As a young man, I used to love cricket, and I use cricket similes here because this is Sri Lanka, and this is, well, look, let me say it this way. When I went to give a talk in Adelaide one time, I was only there for one day, and hardly, it was in the Sri Lankan temple, hardly anybody came to my talk. Because at that day, Sri Lanka were playing Australia in a one-day international. And unfortunately, the competition was too strong for me. So they went to the cricket match instead. But, have you ever been watching a cricket match and think that the batsman or the bowler are hopeless? And you think you could do much better? We always think that way, but if we put ourselves in the position of the person out there facing the ball, it's a difficult position. We criticize people too much. We don't have the empathy to understand what it must be like, you know, being a prime minister of a country. It's not an easy job at all. Every time you make a right decision, a good decision, nobody puts your picture in the newspapers. You make one wrong decision and then it's all over the front page. That is the lack of empathy for the difficulties of a CEO in a position of authority. It's so hard to please everybody all the time. But if we had empathy, you know, for our leaders and CEOs, literally put ourselves in their shoes, we would be much kinder, more accommodating to the people under whom we serve. And number two, it is, as one of the, who's the managing director of the Changi Airport said, how many people, when you go to work, how many of you go to work with the resolution that you're going to make somebody happy today? And people expect you to be made happy. So it would be wonderful if you go to work wanting not just to create successful outcomes, but also happiness at work. And that creating some happiness and bonding at work is very important for success. You know, for bonding, for harmony, for working together. Even people in small jobs, there was one gentleman who was a bus driver, and he told me that this was a dead-end job, that he was just driving a bus all day, and what good was that? It was too simple a job. And so I recommended to him, yes, you are driving a bus, but you meet so many people every day. Many people, you take their fare, and you can have the opportunity to smile at them, to welcome them, to give them some kindness. He said, that means there's a lot you can do for other people's happiness and well-being. That is important in your work, wherever you are. A smile, a little bit of kindness, goes a long way to creating harmony, morale, and eventually profits, success outcomes. If you look after others, then they look after you. It is karma. If you are kind to others, they will be kind back to you. If you serve others, they will serve back. One of my students over in Australia, her work colleague got promotion. And after getting promotion, the attitude changed. One was now a boss, the other one was a subordinate. And they didn't seem to get on together. Until one day, the subordinate was going out to get some coffee and got another cup of coffee for her boss. The type of coffee she knew her boss liked from the time they were working together as colleagues. And just that little act of kindness does getting a cup of coffee for her boss change the relationship now they could actually be kind to one another? And the office politics ended right there with a simple act of kindness. Imagine what it must be like to be a boss. No one is ever kind to you. No one ever respects you, except just, you know, trying to say the right thing. No one ever treats you like a human being, but a boss, a position of authority. And it's wonderful when a person treats you with kindness. This is called bonding, learning how people can work together. Because you may think that the boss is the top of a pyramid. Usually, the hierarchies of organizations, whether it's in a monastery, a temple, in a company, or in an organization, it is a pyramid. But the boss is at the bottom of the pyramid. Imagine an inverted pyramid with the apex at the bottom. Because it is the boss, the CEO, the Hamdro, who supports everybody else. They have a lot of weight and responsibility on their shoulders. Which is one of the reasons why we should have empathy for the people who lead. But those people who lead, first of all, there comes a time, you know, in your positions of leadership where you realize the amount of money which you have, you will never spend. The government will spend it, your children will spend it, the charitable organizations which you support will spend it. There's only a certain amount of money which you will spend. After a while, you realize your continued work is not spending for you. It's spending for others. Charity. Giving. Even so, we still love working. Simply because it is giving. It is giving to our community. And even paying taxes. When you pay taxes because you work, you'll see the results of those taxes in the hospitals which you pass, in the schools which your taxes support. Your hard work is doing good karma for the community, for the society. Sometimes that we find that the hard work we do does have an effect on our society. The taxes built this big hall here where I can give a banner this afternoon. So never think that, you know, the money which you pay to taxes, the money which you earn, is just for yourself. It never is. It's always for others as well. And that should give you lots of happiness. Sometimes the goodness which we do in our work, in our society, in our companies, sometimes we fail to appreciate the results of our hard work. It's not just for ourselves. It's not just even for our family. It will always be to so many other people in our community. Even the people who you employ, that your organizations, your business employs many people, which gives them livelihood, which means they can give their children a good education, they can live comfortably, they can save enough for any difficulties which they have in their life. There's so much which they can do because you supply them with employment. It's not just making money. It's making society. It's making community. It is serving the people in our world. Many people sometimes complain that business is greedy. It is not greedy. As Cheng Bengchu, the former head of Keppel Shipping, CEO, said, companies are not corrupt. People can sometimes be corrupt, and that's why we have laws to restrain that. But companies provide a service for our world. And without them, there would be no employment. There would be no possibility to have aircraft which can fly people like myself around the world to share and to teach. It is important we have companies. However, we have to make sure that the experience we have at work is always going to be a positive one. Now, there is something which is important in which Buddhism can add to the work experience, and that is that one other way of dealing with workplace stress, and it's the stress in the workplace which causes people to be irritable and grumpy. You get grumpy, you have office politics, disagreements, mostly because people are tired. If we can somehow lessen the tiredness, so we're not so exhausted at work, if we can somehow find an easy method to do this, then we'll always find the workplace experience is much more positive, but also much more efficient. There was many people, there was an article which I read in the business pages recently about people seem to spend more and more and more time at work. Longer hours. And they were also saying that this has to be the way of the future. The competition is so tough that we have to work longer and longer hours. However, I disagree with that. Because in order to be productive, which is what we're really talking about, how much work can you get by in one day? It's not just the length of time, it's also the efficiency. And this is something which I noticed many years ago, that productivity goes down in the afternoon when you start to get exhausted. You may see that with your children. If they're doing assignments, homework, there comes a time, they're doing the homework on computers these days, there comes a time when they're looking at a screen for 10, 15, 20 minutes, they're not producing anything at all. Their brain is not working because they're exhausted. And it's the same in the office. You may have to write an email. You have to consider a decision which may be quite crucial for your success of your company. And there are times when your brain is so clogged with tiredness, you can't think clearly. We call that just, you know, the exhaustion. The solution is very simple. And I mentioned this, please excuse me for repeating this, I mentioned this at lunchtime. The simile is with a glass of water. This is now part of the training in Harvard Business School. How heavy is this glass of water? I gave this simile once at Imperial College in London. And some smart aleck said about 85 grams. These were engineers. Said, this is not what I mean. How heavy is this glass of water? After 1 minute, my arm becomes tired. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. After 3 minutes, I'm in agony. And I'm not a very smart monk. What should I do when it starts to get too heavy to hold comfortably? You just put it down and rest. After 1 minute of rest, I pick it up and it feels much lighter. It's the same weight, but because I've rested, I can handle it much easier. Harvard calls this an investment in time. For rest for a few minutes, those few minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, which you relax, you don't try and figure out solutions to problems. If you know how to meditate, you meditate. If you just want to just go for a walk, go for a walk. You relax. That is 20 minutes, half an hour, which you're not working in a sense of doing the job which your boss wants you to do. But in that half an hour which you relax, your brain is recharging, re-energizing, which means in the afternoon you get 3 hours work done in two of high quality, no mistakes because your mind is clear. It's something very simple which we notice as Buddhist monks who meditate, who are mindful, who learn ancient wisdom, that learning how just to relax and put things down is not wasting time. It is making time. One of my friends in New York, he meditates 1 hour every day, except when he's busy. And when he's busy, he meditates 2 hours a day. In other words, he needs to be very clear, very precise, very productive when he's very busy. So this is one little method where Buddhism can affect our business, make it more effective, more productive, with less stress. The classic win-win situation. But more than dealing with stress that way, there's another part of business which is important called innovation. We live in a very competitive world. We have to learn just how to move our practices and our innovation further. Research and development is an important part of economic success. And in order to innovate, we need some new ideas. I'm not sure if you know where the ice cream cone came from. The ice cream cone, which you may get for your children or yourself when you're on holiday or just even on a hot day in Colombo, that originated from the St. Louis World's Fair in 1920-something, where there was a stall selling ice cream located adjacent to a store which had the franchise for selling waffles. And the two gentlemen, one selling waffles, one selling ice cream, were talking to one another, became friends, and they decided, why not combine these two different types of food, which had never gone together before, and they made the waffle into a cone, put the ice cream on top, and that was the origin of the ice cream cone. Two different foods synergizing together. So number one, innovation often comes when we get two different ideas, two different fields coming together and seeing how those two can create new ideas, new products. But even more than that, for innovation, which is important in our business, there is a little simile which I use from Buddhism about insight. And I first performed this little demonstration in Daejeon in South Korea about 2 or 3 years ago in the 2015 World Computer Congress, where I gave the keynote address. And there were many executives from Samsung, LG, the whole of the computer industry in that part of the world, Google, obviously. And they were wondering, what is a Buddhist monk doing giving the keynote address at the World Computer Congress? And so I answered them. I said, if you have another technology expert teaching you more of the same, where is the innovation? Where is the progress going to happen? Sometimes we need to have fertilization from outside our industry, from outside our sphere of experience, in order to try and see things from a slightly different way. I was talking about insight. And this is what I was talking about. I got out a glass of water, it was actually a bottle of water, and I asked the audience, please describe what I'm holding up. And somebody shouted out glass, maybe about 8 inches high, circle at the top, with a stem on the bottom. Yes, keep on looking. What do you see here? And after about 3 or 4 minutes, they'd exhausted the description of what they saw here. You say glass, you say water, you say 80% full, you say heavy. It's more than that. The longer you look, the more you see. After a while, you exhaust what you've been taught. Once you've exhausted your knowledge of what you think this is, then you can start to see it afresh. Once you've exhausted what you've seen. There's something which we say that your learning, your conditioning, is what stands in the way of seeing new things, new opportunities, new angles, new products, new ways of dealing with business. There's always opportunities. If you, instead of seeing things as a glass, you can see things as something else. This is not a glass of water for me. I haven't drunk this. I'm not thirsty. This is my visual aid. You use it for different things. So that is innovation. Looking at new ways of doing things. So in this way that we do have ways of dealing, you know, with our competitive business in today's world. But also we have the difficulty that in any business environment that we have to sometimes give what is called performance assessment. In other words, we have to see somebody in our business who's not arriving at work on time, who's not performing, who's not fitted to the job which they have been given. And this is something which in business, as a professional, people often find it very difficult to sack someone, to tell them that they're not doing the right thing. Even as a handro, sometimes I have to tell monks, with great compassion, that you're getting up too late, you're not in time for the alms round, you're snoring when you're meditating, you're chanting out of key. We have all those things in the mind. And instead of just, being compassionate, be kind, just let it be. Of course, that's not good for the temple, it's not good for myself, it's not good for them. So we do have to criticize people sometimes. And the way we criticize in business, or in a temple, or even in a family, sometimes we just do not know how to give performance assessment. And the Buddha was very clear with the ways of right speech. Before you criticize somebody, first of all, make sure you're not doing the same thing yourself. Otherwise, people don't take you seriously. Even when I was a school teacher for 1 year, the rule in the school was that no child, no student was allowed to smoke. And the students complained to me because as soon as they knocked on the staff room door to ask somebody for a member of staff, there were billows of cigarette smoke came out of the staff room door. And of course, you have to be true to what you do. You have to be authentic. Otherwise, you have no authority. So, first of all, to make sure that, you are not guilty of what you accuse other people to do. And also, to make sure that you have the facts. That you are not misunderstanding, the situation. Because sometimes when a person, you think they may be just late, maybe they were at another appointment, maybe helping the company in some other way, please find out the facts. Don't criticize people too quickly. To make that point, to make that point, many years ago, there were some scandals in the Sangha. There were monks in Thailand who were accused of having mistresses and found out to be true, so they had to be disrobed. So I use that time to show people just how easily we can judge unfairly. So what I did, I decided to make a confession myself. I said, some years ago, I spent some of the happiest hours of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. We kissed, we loved each other so much, and she was married to somebody else. And straight away people said, that's adultery! We thought you were a moral man, Ajahn Brahm, and there you were kissing somebody else's wife. I said, yes, that was my mother. She was married to my father. I was spending some wonderful time in the loving arms of another man's wife. And I said that as an example of how we can add one and one and make three. How we can jump to conclusions which aren't valid. So before you criticize anybody at work, please find out what's really happening, what the truth is. Otherwise, sometimes we get criticized and it's very unfair. And also, use kindness. And how can you use kindness? And this is what we call the sandwich method. You know the sandwiches, you know, in Western food. Actually, we had sandwiches here the other day. Two pieces of bread with a filling inside. The sandwich method works like this. There's somebody in your office who's not performing well. So you go up to them and you tell them what a wonderful job they're doing. How valued they are in this company. And just how they're a great asset to your team. And then, that's the first slice of bread. And then you put the filling in. But, you know, your work is always sloppy. You know, you could sort of be a bit more accurate with your typing or whatever it is. And at the end you say, but, you know, thank you for being here. Other stuff which you do is wonderful and good. Thank you so much. And see if we can help you improve. Because in business, it's not just the salary you get, but it's the experience and growth which you can develop in your work experience. How you can learn and grow in your career, in your job. People want to have pointed out to them their little faults so they can improve in the future. When I was a school teacher, when I was teaching mathematics, and when I had to set my first exam in mathematics, I needed some advice from a senior teacher. And the senior teacher told me, try and set the difficulty level of the test to be 70%, not more, not less. Because if the students got 95%, 100%, there would be no point to the exam, it's just too easy. If they got 50%, 40%, 30%, they would lose their motivation, their confidence. They would think that they just could not do math, and they would give up and do other subjects. They would come up thinking math is too difficult. So, try for 70%. If you get 70% score, that's a pretty good score. It means you get confidence. You can do math. And also it means the 30% where you make mistakes, that's where the teacher, I can know their weak points. Parts of the syllabus which I hadn't explained well enough, I thought they'd understood but they didn't. That 30% is where we learn. It's a growth area. So we don't expect our workers to come in there and always perform 100% level. as their manager, as their boss, where you see them failing, that's 70%. Please put it in context. They're not hopeless people, they're good people, but also we want them to be able to. Okay, yes. So 70% is the best score. So, I have just been given some performance assessment that the Excellency the Prime Minister has to leave soon for another performance. No? Not for Pirikura? Carry on.
On behalf of all of us, he is presenting Pirikara because Pirikara, he has to leave.
So, thank you for that. Very good. So please, whenever you have to leave for your official business, please, please do so. And so, to be able to give feedback to somebody without offending them. How many times have you been told off at work unfairly, and you feel you haven't been appreciated? That you've really worked hard, you've done your very best, and somebody comes along and says, no, you're late, your work is slovenly, it's not good enough. Sometimes that we lose our morale, which is one of the reasons why the work experience gets unpleasant. We don't really want to give. We don't really want to work hard when people treat us like that. A little bit of kindness, sandwich, give praise, then give the criticism, and then give the praise. That is usually one of the best ways it works. And also, the last thing I'm going to say before... Is there a question and answers? There is, good. The last thing which I'm going to say is, a lot of times we focus on our faults too much. By focusing on the faults, what I mean is a company, or a government, or any institution, that they make a mistake. And we always keep thinking about why we made mistakes, why it went wrong. Which if we keep focusing too much on the mistakes of life, we find that we lose our motivation, we lose our confidence, and we get into negativity. And instead, if we would instead focus on successes, what works? So if you had a meeting, not about... know why you lost seats in government, why you lost customer shares. Instead of focusing on the negative in your business, instead focus on what worked. So if you have a product which sells really well, you have a marketing campaign which succeeds, you have policies which become popular, why? Because if you have meetings about what worked instead of meetings about what failed, you'll find you get motivated and you learn from successes much more than you learn from what went wrong. And that even goes to other parts of your life, your relationships, your marriage. If you have a wonderful day together, why? Please remember the secret of a happy day with your partner. Why did it work? And don't keep focusing on why that one day was wrong. Please let that go. Learn from successes, not from mistakes. That hat works in business. It works in politics. And it certainly works in monasteries. In Buddhism, we learn from what works, and we grow from what works. We keep repeating what works. It is called watering the flowers, not watering the weeds. Focusing on the mistakes brings negativity. Focusing on what works brings a very positive, beautiful mind. Thank you for listening and thank you for your attendance. Okay, so is there an opportunity for some questions you have?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
To keep the day in place, we received few questions in advance. So we have selected few questions which we think will be useful to you. The first one is a naughty question, Bhante.
Very good.
The first noble truth is about unsatisfactoriness of life and dukkha. But all the time, you look so happy. Is it real or is this your advertising?
That's so naughty. That's not naughty. It's, if I just put on happy smile just for show, then I'd soon be found out. I am now a very well documented monk. And so the happiness has to be real. And if you were playing a role, you get so tense after a while that you would even get sick. So the happiness is real. But how can that be? I gave a series of talks in Indonesia called Happy Every Day. How can you be happy every day? Number one, what about nighttime? It meant nighttime as well. What happens when you're sick, when you're grumpy, when things didn't go your way? How can you be happy then? And the point is, happy to be grumpy. Happy to be tired. Happy to be wrong sometimes. Happy to fail sometimes. So, happy to be sick. Sickness is a good example. Is there anyone in this room who's never been sick in their life? If there are anyone who's never been sick in this life, please put your hand up now. I can assume that everyone has been sick. If someone had put their hand up, they'd never been sick ever in their life, you'd be so weird, so strange, they'd take you to some medical facility and do tests on you. In fact, if you're always healthy every day of your life, there'd be something wrong with you. It's all right to be sick. It's natural to be sick. It's normal to be sick. So why do people say there's something wrong with me? I'm sick. My students in Australia are well known that when they go to their GP, they go to the GP's office and, "Doctor, there's something right with me. I'm sick again." In other words, we're accepting that sickness is part of life. We're happy to be sick. We accept being sick. We open the door of our heart to life as it is. Very good. Have a good meeting. So we open the door of our heart to life. So we're happy no matter what happens. When you understand suffering, dukkha, we accept it. This is, my teacher had this wonderful saying, joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. Joy at last to know there's no happiness in the world. What does that mean? It means no longer are you complaining, you're thinking there's something wrong with you, wrong with this world, wrong with life. It is part of life. So when happiness comes, you enjoy it. When the difficulties come, that's part of life. It is the suffering of life is where we learn. The mistakes of life are where we grow. Without those, there will be no growth. This is why the 70% rule is so important. If your life is always 100%, always happy, successful, no problems in your life, you learn nothing. There's the difficulties, the troubles, the trials of life. That is where people grow. very easy simile, which is one of my favorites. If when you go home and you're walking home for good exercise, and if you tread in the dog poo, never scrape it off your shoes until you get home. Always take the dog poo home with you. Only scrape it off when you get to your garden. And in your garden, you scrape it off under, say, the mango tree. Because 1 year later, your mangoes will be sweeter and juicier than ever before. Why? Because dog poo is great fertilizer. The difficulties of life are where we grow. The problems you have in your business are opportunities. This is where growth happens in life. Yes, suffering is the first noble truth. But it also leads to happiness and to enlightenment. It's where we learn and grow.
Are you ready for the next question?
Yeah, go on.
Okay, this is another interesting question. You partly touched on this. As professionals, we tend to think as personal life and professional life. But as you know these days, the work responsibilities go beyond 8 to 5. We are 24/7. And as a result, we get more focused on the professional responsibilities and the business responsibilities than family and even health. You gave a small example, but can you give a few tips how we can, if you can balance, at least juggle between these two aspects of life?
Yes, we have so many responsibilities, just family, our social life, political life, business life. And how we juggle between those is, again, a story. A young man from Sydney went to see Ajahn Chah in Thailand. He just went all that way just to get some advice from an enlightened master. And he came back afterwards and told me what happened. Ajahn Chah was just so famous at that time. Even though he came all that way from Sydney to Thailand, he couldn't even get close. Couldn't get close to see Ajahn Chah. So he gave up after waiting 2 hours, realizing that his taxi was not going to come for another hour to take him to the station, the railway station, to get the ride back to Bangkok and the aircraft back home. So he decided to just go back and wait, and he saw some monks doing some sweeping. He decided to help out, do some sweeping, nothing else to do. At that point, while he was sweeping, he felt an arm on his hand. And it was Ajahn Chah, out of loving kindness, saw this man who had come such a long way and decided to give him a very quick teaching. He said, whatever you do, give it everything you've got. And he went away. And that little piece of advice meant so much. He went back and realized that was all the lesson he needed. When he was at work, he gave work everything he got. He never thought of his family or the dinner he was going to have in the evening. He gave work everything he had. When he was with his family, he gave his family everything he had. He didn't worry about work. When it was time to go to bed at night, he gave sleep everything he had. He was not concerned about the problems in his family or the problems with work. He gave sleep everything he had. When he was enjoying himself, watching a cricket match, he was right there in the cricket match, not worrying about his business or anything else. Whatever he was doing, he gave it 100%. When he was meditating, he gave that 100%. He said that made him a very successful businessman, a very happy family man, and also a very good meditator as well. Too much, we're at work, we're thinking about family. We're in the family, we're thinking about the cricket match. We're in the cricket match, and we're thinking about dinner. We're in sleep, and we're thinking about everything. So we never manage to get a good night's sleep. It's giving everything you have with what you've got. And the second story is, this is part of the training in the Human Resources Department of Cathay Pacific. It was a simple teaching of the Emperor's Three Questions, which is almost like the Dhamma in brief. Emperor's Three Questions, a story by Leo Tolstoy. An emperor was so upset about religions always arguing with one another, so he wanted to make it simple but practical. He realized he only needed the answers to three questions. When is the most important time? Who's the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? And after a long journey, which was a story which Leo Tolstoy told in the Book of Short Stories, the answer was that obviously now is the most important time. And the most important person is the one right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. And the most important thing to do is to care. Those three answers become a meditation method which I've used to great success. When people say that they're sick, what should I do? Whatever's in front of you, that's the most important thing to be aware of. Happening right now. Don't try and get rid of it to something else. And care for it. Don't try and cure it. Get rid of it. Care for it. The HR manager of Cathay Pacific took that on board. Because in a service industry where you have clients in front of you, whoever they are right in front of you, they're the most important person in the world. Care for them, be there for them, and then you can listen to them, you can hear them, and they know they're being listened to and given importance to. In the service industry, that changes everything. Even in the relationships which you have at work, you're in front of somebody, a client, or it could be a supplier. When they're right in front of you, you have to connect with them, listen to them, hear them. And then they become the most important person in the world. They really feel that, which means that you have a connection, you learn from one another, and your personal relationships grow. That is how we balance. And there comes a time when you're by yourself. Even if you're married, the last person you see before you go to sleep at night is yourself. I always say, good night me, have a good night's sleep. And when I wake up in the morning, here I am again, good morning, have a good day, Ajahn Brahm. I welcome myself, because a lot of time in this world, you are by yourself. So be kind to yourself, you're important too. So it's not really a balance anymore. It's just every moment is the same. You're by yourself, you're with other people, you're resting, you're meditating, you're serving, you're talking. As Mark Twain once said, make your vocation your vacation. And then the life-work balance. My life is my work. My work is my life. My family. People say, Ajahn Brahm, you've got no family. I've got so many children, so many brothers and sisters. You are my family. And I really mean that. You connect with people. So I've got many, many children, many brothers, many sisters. You're my family. I like spending time with you.
Okay, the next question. We listen to talks like this. We go for programs and we learn things and we make resolutions. On New Year Day, Anniversary Day, Birthday, and we try to pick a few new habits, and again we are back to old habits. How can we break this habit of forming habits, Bhante?
Break the habit of forming habits. There's something which in business, you know, that advertising, it's usually understood for every dollar you spend in advertising, you get $3 return. That's usually the industry standard. Why does advertising work? The reason why advertising works is called brainwashing. And every time I give a talk, I'm quite upfront honest about this. For the last hour, I've been brainwashing you. Especially sometimes when you tell funny stories. Because people think, oh, you're not really being serious. That is where you lower your guard. and the message gets in from underneath. Have you seen the advertisements they have on television? They're stupid, they're banal. Who would ever believe those things you see on TV? And I remember the time I was a student. I thought I was an intellectual. I thought I was smart. There was an advertisement on TV, and I remember it to this day, for St. Bruno tobacco. And this was a time where I didn't smoke cigarettes, but you had a pipe. You know, all intellectuals had a pipe. Albert Einstein had a pipe. So I decided, no, having a pipe would be very cool. And the advertisement showed this ordinary-looking young man walking down the street somewhere in England. No one was bothering him. And then he took out a pipe, put the tobacco inside, lit it, and apparently the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco was irresistible to women. So this ordinary-looking guy walked past a grocery shop, and this beautiful blonde jumped over the counter to follow him. Then he went past a newsagent, and there was an equally beautiful redhead also had to leave and just follow him, waiting for his every command. It was like a young man's fantasy. After about a few minutes, a whole bevy of beautiful women were following this guy. Because St. Bruno tobacco, irresistible to girls. How stupid that was. Who would ever believe that? I did. I bought some of that tobacco, and I went down the street in Cambridge smoking it, and the only thing to follow me was a dog. Have you ever done anything stupid like that? You really feel that you are in control of your mind. Your mind is conditioned all the time. It's one of the reasons why an old Buddhist story, which is really important, is the story of the bad elephant. That was the title of my best-selling book in Germany. I mean, really, such a success in Germany, the elephant who lost its happiness, that there's a whole section of the bookshops in Germany. I was invited over to Germany to go on the talk shows, the night talk shows, because it was really popular. And people wondered, why is people in Germany buying this book in droves? It was the Spiegel bestseller, still is on the list. Elephant Lost Its Happiness is an old Buddhist story of a royal elephant who suddenly, for no apparent reason, started to become cantankerous, naughty. You know, when the king would go past, he would squirt water at the king. He would poo just when the keeper was right behind it. It was a very bad elephant. And so the king wanted to know why. Why was it such a good elephant before and suddenly changed its character? No one could find the reason. No medical reason for it. And so they got, you know, the Bodhisattva, like many Jataka tales, was a minister, said, I'll try and find out. So he went behind the elephant's door, sat there overnight at night, and then maybe 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, he was woken up by a sound. There was some bandits, some bad people were meeting there every evening to discuss where they would steal, who would they beat up, who would they even kill. They would discuss that. That was their meeting place every evening, right behind the elephant stall. And even though the elephant could not understand human language, could still pick up on the bad feelings, the bad emotions of those brigands, those bad people, that gang. And so the minister had those thieves arrested, and the next day had the bhikkhus, the monks, go there to meditate and chant Pirit. And even though the elephant could not understand Pirit chanting, couldn't understand Sinhala, let alone Pali, but could understand the goodness, the kindness of those monks. And that changed the elephant. And the elephant became a very kind, peaceful person. It is associating with good people, the brainwashing, that's important for people. That is how we change habits. not by resolution, but by spending time associating with good people. It's one of the reasons why people sometimes send their husbands to the temple for a week to do a meditation retreat, and they come back like servicing a car, new and improved. Because they get off on the energy of the monks or the nuns. So this is actually just how habits are changed. By associating with good people, with kind people.
I think we have time for one last question out of all these things. I'll ask a generic question. When we work with people in offices, we tend to spend more time with people in office than with our family members. As a result, people in the offices tend to understand you better sometimes than your family members. And this can sometimes tilt the balance of relationships. What's your advice?
Well, an example was of an engineering firm in Birmingham some years ago, which won a business award. In just 12 months, when they enacted this strategy, they found that their turnover tripled, their profits doubled within 12 months. Profits doubled in 12 months. And the strategy they had was to ban all overtime. You could not take work back at the end of the day. And the reason that worked was, first of all, staff turnover went to zero. Nobody wanted to leave such a company. And anyone who's in business knows you get key members of staff. Sometimes they leave because of sickness or because of their work satisfaction is low. Or sometimes they just get poached by other companies with better offers. And it takes roughly about 6 months to 9 months to train somebody up to the same level of competence and experience to the person you've just lost. Staff turnover is a huge and negative economic and also productive loss to the company or organization. So number one, no staff turnover anymore. And number two, many people in the office are not working productively because they're worried about their children or their family problems. They can't give their attention 100% to the work. Once they could go home in the evening, it meant they could spend time with their family. Their children saw them, their husband, their wife spent time together. The whole family experience was so positive. They could sleep well at night, and when they went to work the following morning, they were relaxed. They had a good night's sleep. They were ready to work the following day. Yes, they didn't work as long hours, but they were far more productive because they had rested. They weren't stressed out. They didn't have so much need for medical leave. A simple strategy like that, kindness, works. So lessening the amount of time you have to work creates more productivity. You get literally more out of your workers when you send them home. Go, 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 go. They have to go home. Life-work balance is productive, both for the family and for the company.
Yes. Talking about life-work balance, so this is after a long weekend, and tomorrow is work day. So I think with that, it's time to conclude this very interesting discussion. And there are some pirikaras to be offered on behalf of us by the Madam Kusin. And to those who have been watching this program on live streaming, from tomorrow, tomorrow also at the same time, starting from 4:30, we will be live streaming another discussion with Venerable Ajahn Brahmavanso. It will be more on general topics. Today it was more focused on professionals and business leaders. Once again, thank you very much, all the people who made this event possible. And once again, our deepest, most sincere respect to Ajahn Brahm. Thank you very much, and I have a pleasant evening. And until Venerable Brahmavanso leaves the hall, please remain in your seats. Thank you.